I won't wish you luck, because Jamie Lee Ross is our guy, and I think he'll do a fabulous job, but you know, we like democracy though.
Regarding a grown-up conversation about debt,
yep.
Prime Minister, on the 26th of January, I sent you an Official Information Act request asking, on a line-by-line accounting basis, could you please provide the detailed information which shows exactly to whom New Zealand has become indebted since National Act government came to power in November 2008. And I asked in particular the information which confirms whether or not New Zealand has become indebted to the Bank of America, any subsidiaries of the Bank of America, or any lending institutions of any form which have connections to the Bank of America. I have yet to have an acknowledgement to this request. The reason why I'm asking, Prime Minister, is because according to the Register of Pecuniary Interest, you are a shareholder in the Bank of America, and are you personally profiting from New Zealand's growing indebtedness? And when will I get an answer to my question?
Sadly, no, I'm not. So we get an answer in June, of course, that comes from those people who got that together. I wouldn't have a clue whether they borrowed any money off them. They would, they do it at commercial rates. And the reason I'm a shareholder of Bank of America is because I was a very long-term shareholder of Merrill Lynch. And I thought the company was very well run, but unfortunately when I left it wasn't, and Bank of America bought them when they went broke.
And you can watch that video at youtube.com/Mr News Gorilla Media because you've really, really got to watch it to see his tell signs, his physical reactions and all of that kind of stuff. It is classic. Love to see the Prime Sinister squirm. Speaking of making the sinister squirm, I believe we have on the line a very special guest coming live from New Zealand, as I said, Gordon Israel. Gordon, are you there, mate?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, I'd love it if you'd actually divulge just a little bit about yourself, you know, who you are and how you really got into activism.
Oh, well, the short version is I was born and raised in America, and my father's a Yankee, my mother's a Southern Belle, and I've been torn between the war between the states ever since. So I grew up knowing there was something wrong with the world, wasn't sure what it was, and about the day I got my first paycheck at age 17, I decided it was the income tax that was wrong with the world. And so I spent a number of years plotting and scheming how I could get out of income tax. And I had actually lived for a few years of my childhood in the Caribbean. So I read somewhere that if you had an offshore company, that you could get all of your income offshore, and you didn't owe any tax in America on that. And that resonated with me, because I could immediately see it. Unlike a fair number of Americans, I actually knew what it was to live outside of the country. And so with that as a starting point, I tried to figure out how I could structure my life to get out of income tax by being outside the country financially, but still living inside the country. And it only took me a few years to figure out that you actually had to be pretty darn wealthy for that to be a worthwhile course of action. So I gave up on that, and about the time I gave up on that, some businessmen made headlines. This was, I think, 1999, because they took out full-page advertisements in the USA Today newspaper, which goes across the country, of course, saying that we do not withhold income tax from our employees' paychecks because there's no law that requires us to. And I... That got my attention, because in the world that I was raised in, these guys were convicted criminals. You know, there was no need to hold a trial. It was just a matter of locking them up and then figuring out how long they're supposed to stay behind bars. I mean, with an admission of like that. And I then saw a newspaper article in the New York Times, and it talked about these men. And I knew just enough then to know that I should not pay attention to what they said. I didn't really care what their opinion was. I wanted the part of the newspaper article where they go get the opposite opinion. And I wanted the opinion of the commissioner of the IRS. So sure enough, halfway down the article, they go and interview the commissioner. And his line, his answer, was probably the single most important statement ever to change my thinking. He said, if these men have done anything wrong, they will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. Now, that if just absolutely shattered my illusions, shattered my reality, because in my mind, these guys were already tried and convicted and behind bars. I already had them there, right? If I'd been the judge, the jury, these guys were already behind bars, and the only thing I was going to discuss with them or with anybody was how long they should stay behind bars. And this guy, who's the man who should know, was saying, if. So that's where it all began for me.
Now, income tax, whenever I try to tell people about it, they say, oh, well, you've got to pay your income tax. You know, how else do we get our roads and our hospitals and all of that? And I thought it was the income tax in itself is separate from all the other, 1,000-plus different types of taxes that we pay. And it all just goes to pay debt to foreign banks, which our Prime Minister John Key is lovingly getting us into, considering he's got shares in them.
Yes, well, I can tell you, I mean, we now need to fast forward, 11 years. It's been 11 years since I read that article in the New York Times. We've learned a whole lot more since. Now, I can tell you with certainty that it doesn't matter where that money is going, okay? It's all a smokescreen. The whole monetary ruse is a massive, massive smokescreen. They sit there and they pretend that it's so terribly important that they get X number of dollars out of you this year, you know, to pay for this, to pay for that. Of course, I don't know the situation in America. In New Zealand, I think that half of our road tax, which, of course, we pay at the petrol station, half of that goes to the roads. And the other half goes to fund other government programs. And, the income tax itself goes to pay basically the interest on the national debt. But again, that's all a smokescreen. It's, they're talking numbers that are beyond our ability to comprehend. Right? You can count the stars in the sky by talking in billions. That's astronomical numbers. And yet, Barack Obama will rattle a trillion off as if it's nothing. And
well,
I just yesterday...
He can do that, though, can he? Because they've got a whole bunch of money that they can make up out of thin air.
Yeah, that's another smokescreen. They don't exactly make it up out of thin air. We make it up for them. Okay? We actually make
well,
it up for them. I had a conversation just about a year ago now with the fellow from the Reserve Bank here in New Zealand, and he shattered some of my illusions. He was a wonderful, friendly gentleman, absolutely honest. I could see it in his face. You talk about the body language of Prime Minister John Key when he's asked these questions. We watched this man's body language, and we knew what he told us was gospel truth. And I can tell you that they do not make up the money out of thin air. There is a mechanism for it that is actually quite sensible, and we're the ones, we create the inflation, we create the ridiculous numbers. Basically, when we go down to our bank and say, oh yeah, that house that sold for $100,000 last year, because the bank is willing to give me the loan, I'll pay $200,000 this year. Okay, and we sign on the dotted line.
Alan Bollard. Did you get a
chance
to speak to Alan Bollard?
No, it wasn't Alan Bollard. Okay. You know, he's the governor. Yeah. Now, this was, you know, somebody within the bank, you know, whose job was specific to the questions we were asking.
Our Reserve Bank of New Zealand is actually not such a corrupt institution as the Federal Reserve Bank. I mean, our Reserve Bank of New Zealand is actually owned by New Zealand, as far as I understand. But it is toothless because most of our currency, most of our issuance, it doesn't come from it. It doesn't come from
the institution. Well, I'll give you look, I'm going to blow the lid on something. You know how to find the truth of any situation? The guys running the show actually are very honest folks. All right? They're very, very truthful. You just have to know where they put the truth. And what they do, because it's worked for them for so long and so well, is they stick the truth in symbols. So, are you familiar with the New Zealand coat of arms?
Oh, yeah.
And it's got a shield in the center of it, as all coat of arms do. What color is that shield?
It's a red shield, isn't it?
No. Now, the New Zealand coat of arms that you find in the courtrooms and stuff, it's a blue shield. Blue, which signals maritime law, that we're in a maritime jurisdiction.
Okay.
Okay. So now if you walk into the Reserve Bank, this is the New Zealand Reserve Bank, and you just walk through the front doors and look straight ahead, straight down to the end of the corridor, there, staring you in the face, is a different coat of arms. Different to the New Zealand coat of arms. Now, what do coat of arms signify?
The house.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, these days we go, obviously, if New Zealand's got a coat of arms, that signifies our government. So,
the House of Parliament, or like the Rothschild, have a red shield. That's what Rothschilds mean. So it's the House of Rothschild. Yeah.
So what color do you reckon the shield is on the coat of arms of the Reserve Bank?
No idea.
Red, won't it? It'll be red, but the opposite of the blue.
That's a red shield.
Ah.
That's a red shield. So who owns the New Zealand Reserve Bank of New Zealand is advertised in plain sight for anybody who wants to walk in the doors at number 2, the Terrace Wellington.
Who do they say officially owns the Reserve Bank?
Oh, yes, they will tell you. There's always an official storyline, okay?
So they will say,
yes, we're owned by the New Zealand government.
But in terms of transparency, we could force them under the Freedom of Information Act to give up their ownership details.
No, it's not necessary. Not necessary. You see,
well, it is necessary for people who don't understand symbology. You see what I mean? Because they're, in their epistemology, the burden of proof wouldn't be in a different colored shield.
Well, all I can say is that when you know what you're looking for, you find it, and then you also know how to move forward. You see, if I needed this in writing in order to take the next step, well, then I'd go do a Freedom of Information Act request. And funny enough, I am actually considering a Freedom of Information Act request to the Reserve Bank. But you could probably guess for the rest of the day and not guess what question I want them to come clean on.
Well, let's
I could guess, but
not stand on ceremony.
I want the details, not of the national debt. I want the details of my own bond that they are managing for me.
So you want the stock value of your bond, of your dividend on the New York Stock Exchange that they stopped New Zealanders from getting a few years back when they took the number off the bottom of our the equivalent of your social security number, which you can look up as a trackable stock. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. For those of you who are not aware, when you're born, your birth certificate has a barcode number or a shipping number kind of thing. And if you can search that number on the New York Stock Exchange to find out how much you're worth, all right? Because you are property of your government when you're born with a birth certificate. And the birth certificate is basically a receipt.
And it relates to your mass and everything else. That's why even in metric countries, childbirths are still measured in pounds.
Okay. Do you know what the real purpose of that bond is?
To act as an offset to the amount of money that said government can borrow from the central banks as
close.
A collateral on the debt.
Close. Yeah. Close. It is indeed an offset. Okay. Now, again, the central government borrows from us. This is what we learned from the Reserve Bank. The central government borrows from us with our consent. It works like this. You want to understand government borrowing? It works like this. It's quite simple. First of all, there's no there's an insignificant amount of money out there in the form of Reserve Bank notes and coins. In New Zealand, it's, at any given time, it's 2 to 3% of our economy. So, you know, if you want to crash the economy, just close the banks and rely on cash alone, and you instantaneously evaporate 97-98% of the entire economy. So the government is not borrowing cash from the Reserve Bank like many people believe. What the government is borrowing is bank credit from the banks. But how does that bank credit come into existence? As I just said, it comes into existence every time you trot into the bank and sign on the dotted line. And they, through a mechanism that is not quite, it's not creating it out of thin air, through a mechanism that involves your birth certificate, they put that credit into circulation. So when you go borrow $200,000 for a house at the bank, that gets offset by a $200,000 ledger book entry against your birth certificate. Okay, so that's what the birth certificate, that's part of how the birth certificate is used. Now there's $200,000 in bank credit sitting around the economy, and the Treasury goes out there. Now these are private people passing around bank credits all over the world. The Treasury goes out there and issues bonds which are purchased by private parties. So people who have got their hands on some of this private credit go and voluntarily, again, purchase New Zealand government bonds, and now the national debt goes up. So it's a totally voluntary system. It's unbelievably just. There's no gun to anybody's head here.
Conveniently, very special guest coming at us live from New Zealand is Gordon Israel. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show on American Freedom Radio and TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, and brought to you in proud collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. If you'd like to listen to our Kiwi guests, go to our Kiwi Collaborators archive section. We'll be right back after the break with more from Gordon Israel.
What is about? There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Usury is not dead. In fact, it's never been more alive. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. Speaking of collaborators, our Kiwi Collaborator segment today, we are joined by Gordon Israel. Gordon, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Now, speaking of a New World Order, I'd love it if you could actually define how did the system, as effed up as it is, actually get created? And more to the point, who's responsible for it? if you're able to even answer that question, because I sure as heck can't.
Well, I trace the roots roots of it. Certainly the foundations of our modern system, all the key aspects, I trace back to Queen Elizabeth I and one of her main advisors, Sir Francis Bacon. And Bacon is well known for his cryptography, Baconian ciphers, and a few other things, but he's actually suspected of being the actual brains behind Shakespeare, and he was known to have a circle of the key intellectuals of his day, and he had an agenda. He was also a Mason, and he had an agenda that he executed amazingly well, although most of the work that we see other people get credited for. So Shakespeare would be one example. The King James Bible, this is the 400th year anniversary of the King James Bible. That would have been commenced while Bacon was still around under Queen Elizabeth I. And a number of other things, including my personal favorite, the East India Company, which is a corporation formed in around 1602, and still legally, you know, a legally structured company to this day, even though they will tell you in the history that it was shut down sometime in the 1700s, I believe.
They went through a rebranding process.
Yeah, well, a fellow from India apparently bought the shares a couple of years ago. So obviously there had to be shares worth purchasing. So how is it that company is still in existence? Somebody hung on to the shares all these years.
Yeah.
Anyway, it would take a lot longer than you have on this show to then detail what Sir Francis Bacon laid out, you know, as his plan. But in essence, you had several different systems of law rolled out. The common law was enshrined in the King James Bible, and then they rolled out admiralty law across the planet, starting first with the East India Company. Most people think of the sun never setting on the British Empire, but what they don't know is that the British Empire was not the British Empire. The British Empire was the East India Company. And if you look at the history, at the time of Queen Elizabeth I, England was a little island out the back of nowhere. Nobody cared about it. Spain was the reigning power, the European superpower. They'd been stealing gold from the Americas for 100 years. Nobody could stop them. And Queen Elizabeth, I suspect with the help of a key advisor, came up with a very simple plan. And the simple plan was that stop trying to do it all yourself, Your Majesty. You're too small, impotent. You don't have the power. You don't have the wealth. Can't possibly rally the resources. Give your individual subjects the motivation to go out and do what you want. So at the time, with the Spanish bringing back all of these ships laden with gold, the private motivation was a bunch of English buccaneers out there. They're pirates. They're just raiding these Spanish ships as they were able to. And what Queen Elizabeth came up with was the concept of privateering. She legitimized piracy by giving them a commission. Now, if you've ever dealt with a commissioner, you've dealt with somebody with a commission. And she gave commissions to the privateers and told them, now, if you go attack the Spanish ships, because I'm at war with Spain, you see, what you're doing is legal, and you now have my official blessing. And
so it's like
suddenly...
It's like legalizing mercenary activity, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, the most famous privateer of her day was Sir Francis Drake, and you can read all of his history. And the most famous triumph, if you will, of the privateers was against the Spanish Armada. Spain thought, yep, we're going to say, you know, we're the superpower. We're going to sail around England and take over that little no-count island. And it was not Queen Elizabeth and her wealth and power that stopped them. It was a bunch of privateers with documents signed by her that basically said, fire at will.
Yeah, I mean, now we're getting into it, but I don't think we've got enough time to actually delve right into the blood on the hands of the East India Company. But Francis Bacon certainly was an interesting individual. And as you'd probably know, he's a member of the Hellfire Club, because Masonry wasn't too hardcore enough for him. And but he also is identified with the Baconian method, which is known as the scientific method, and he's
correct.
The father of empiricism, what most people think is empirical logic. And this is what gets me about the scientific establishment of today. Like, I believe in science too, and I believe in the application of science as a tool set to understand the world, not as the meaning of the world.
Yeah.
See, this is the problem. Or anyway, this is just my little rant. On the personal side note here, the problem I see in a lot of people's thinking today is that the scientific method has been compromised, and it's basically rooted in these occultists like Francis Bacon and their own.
Well, what does the word occult
mean? Case in point, climate cultists.
Exactly.
What's that?
Exactly. Climate cultists and evolutionists too, believe
it or not. Yeah, but what does the word occult mean?
Hidden.
Hidden, that's right. Secret knowledge. And Bacon certainly had access to some secret knowledge that he let out. If you read the Baconian method, yes, he absolutely changed science. He laid the foundation for the modern scientific method. The man was a genius. He created, as far as I can tell, and I'm no expert on Bacon. I just lift the lid on things and see what I find there. But he created the modern world. We would not have travel by jet aircraft today were it not for Sir Francis Bacon telling people what logical path to follow to discover natural laws. Natural laws such as lift from an airplane's wing. How do you figure that out? His Baconian method laid the foundation for that.
Yeah, but I don't know whether that's Bernoulli's theorem in particular, that one, but there were like minds on similar paths all around the world, but there were kind of philosophical differences between people on the same scientific path as him at the time, you could say. But then his version was dominant, just like Darwin versus Lamarck, for instance. Darwin was dominant because he was backed by the eugenicist scum occult freaks who run Britain.
Yeah, but I see. What I see is I see a big difference between Darwin and Bacon, because I can't fault anything that so far that I've read that Bacon has written. It may not be that he has the entire truth, but certainly he's not promoting. He wasn't promoting falsehood. A skewed view of the world. Your question was about the New World Order and how, that was formed, and he laid all the foundations that we now see coming to fruition today. Without the foundations that he laid, with the blessing of Queen Elizabeth and later on King James, we wouldn't be in the world we're in today.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people get real freaked out by that, but I'm not, because I eat bacon for breakfast.
Yes, I do find his name somewhat humorous, especially since a lot of people think he was Jewish.
A lot of people say it's a fake name, but anyway. There's no doubt that a lot of great things in this world wouldn't have come without sort of their cornerstones, so to speak.
Are you familiar with his treatise called A New Atlantis, or The New Atlantis?
Exactly. So this is the whole point, is Bacon was laying out some certain principles in future vision of the world that he wanted to see, in keeping with their idea of the great work. And yep. then they just go and say, oh, conspiracy theorists think he was a Mason or a Rosicrucian or a Templar or this, that, and the other.
Yep.
Well, it's no theory. I mean, like he was openly in, he openly commenced the Hellfire Club, co-commenced it, in central London. Anyway, without going into Baker too much, going back to the New Zealand coat of arms, I see there's actually blue and red in a diametric pattern, symmetrical pattern on the New Zealand coat of arms. And in one, in the bottom left-hand corner, there is, in fact, a sheaf of wheat.
Yep.
And you know what that represents?
Actually, no. I don't know every symbol out there, but I'll tell you what another one of them represents.
Well,
so tell us what the wheat is.
The wheat, just like the oil and the wine, the wheat is an intrinsic part of Masonic ritual, and the wheat generally represents the fruits of our labor.
Yeah.
But that's just a low level, anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, carry on. Sorry.
But the how many ships are on the New Zealand coat of arms?
It's three of them.
Three of them. Now, how many have you ever, you probably have never, but you can look this up, look up the coat of arms of the East India Trading Company. Guess
what
how many ships are on it.
About the East India Trading Company was the flag, you know. It's got the British Union Jack and then the red and white stripes of the U.S. flag. Which
that's right. That's exactly right. Yep.
You know, and it's like, oh, hold on a second. So what's going on
the
here?
The symbolism, like I say, it's all hidden in the symbolism, you see. So New Zealand is a jurisdiction. It's a sub-jurisdiction of the East India Company. That's what the three ships tell us.
You see red, white, and blue on the Dutch flag, the French flag, the British, obviously the Union Jack, which is a swastika.
Yeah.
American, New Zealand, Australian. You see red, white, and blue because these aren't U.S. colors. That's nonsense.
No, that's right.
These are Masonic colors. They go from one end of the spectrum to the other, and then white is the combined spectrum of light.
Yeah. I've got a simpler explanation for that, and that is that red is common law, represents blood. White is ecclesiastical law for purity, and blue is maritime law for water.
Yeah, I was just going beyond that and saying why, because the spectrum of light goes from infrared to ultraviolet. Yeah, ultraviolet can be simplified as blue, and infrared can be simplified as red.
Sure.
So they cover the whole spectrum. That's why the Labour Party represents themselves as red, and the National Party represents themselves as blue, and between the two-party system, they cover the whole spectrum of society in their control. And that's how they do it.
Sure.
And you combine all the spectrum of light, which they say they ask for more light, and they believe Lucifer is light and everything else. You combine all the light and you get white.
Yep. But, you see, I look at these symbols and I see the good in them. I think it's just downright nice and honorable of the Rothschilds to tell us in plain English, plain symbols, easily understood symbols, that they own the Reserve Bank. It really warms my heart. You know, I walk in there, and I know who I'm dealing with.
Right? Murdering scum. Yeah.
I love those honest, honorable murdering scum. You know.
Well, look, I just explained to you how the national debt and consequently the inflation and all that that comes with it is entirely a product of individual decisions made by private people such as you and me.
Oh, yes. And we'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with our very special guest, Gordon Israel, final segment after the break on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.
We can be more than ever people, more than ever people.
gentlemen to the show that's all about being just a little bit better than scum. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. It's a friggin' miracle that we haven't been assassinated yet. Yet being the operative word. Our very special guest who joins me on that sentiment is Gordon Israel, coming at us live from New Zealand. Gordon, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Now, Will, you had a little something to say, because the occultists, you know, meaning the hidden and that kind of thing, society's run in a very underhanded way, isn't it? And the only way that it keeps continuing to function in such an underhanded way is because the truth is kept secret and has been for quite a long time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hear what you're saying, Gordon. I mean, that in a lot of ways the public consents to this, you know, whatever's been run on them, but largely they do it not out of knowing, but because the establishment are so good at hiding things in plain view, and because people aren't educated in a certain way in order to respond to it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, at the same time as I can see the average individual's to blame, I'm to blame, everyone's to blame, I still blame the elite, because they've set this up knowingly, and they knowingly deceive people.
Yeah. So two things come to mind. One is, if what they're doing is so evil, why do they hide so many clues in plain sight? And that's the first question. And the second one is, there's a fella who hung around, was known to hang around in a certain part of this earth 2,000 years ago, who intentionally spoke everything in riddles. We call them parables. And, you know, his disciples asked him, well, why do you teach in parables? And he said, this is not stuff the common man's entitled to know, more or less. I mean, I'm not quoting him verbatim, of course. And yet people go and worship this guy on, you know, Sundays, most every week, you know, of the year, and say he was a really good guy and he wanted the best for the world. So why do you keep his message secret?
I can answer those two. The first one is that the establishment put out code and talk in analogy and use symbology, so that only an elect is a way of initiating people.
Yeah.
You only get the initiates you want. And so only an elect can understand, and then they'll go, oh, well, you can understand us. Hey, do you want to join? And they'll say no, and they'll say, okay, we're going to stuff your life up. And so fine. But it's question number two. So question number one is basically secret societies don't want scum joining their groups who don't understand them. Question number two is that and when it comes to parables and so on, and why Jesus spoke in riddles, you could say, according to a lot of... according to Paul and John and whoever else, I mean, that was also to not just protect knowledge, but to make sure that only those who truly loved God and understood God in a higher form could become close to that knowledge.
Yep.
It's the same way. So secret societies like want initiates that are capable of understanding on their level, in the same way that supposed creator would.
Yeah. Well, I'm in full agreement with you.
They're not actually doing that. That's just controlled, corporate, organized religion bullshit. People like idiots like Benny Hinn and freaks jumping around on stage. They don't understand Jack.
Let's not go there. I'm in full agreement with you on your second answer about why Jesus spoke in parables. Now, your first answer about keeping things speaking in code, you have to be an initiate in order to understand it. I'm not a Mason. Never been even asked to join the Masons. I have over the years had some friends and relatives who were Masons, and one or two in particular saw fit to just fill me in on a few bits and snatches of Masonic history. And, I suppose it was
Bible,
against
that's
their...
what you're pushing at.
What's that?
They didn't write the Bible, if that's what they told you.
No. No, they
all make the pyramids.
They told me some very interesting bits of Masonic history that was, you know, common knowledge to a Mason, but not common knowledge, certainly not taught in the schools and Anyway, a few years later, I was just absolutely floored when I watched a particular movie, and I saw all this same history, just as they had told it to me, put in this movie and ascribed to the Masons. Did you know what movie that is?
National Treasure.
June.
Bingo.
June.
Bingo. National Treasure. Like Walt Disney.
Nicolas Cage, really?
Nicolas Cage.
National Treasure 2. Wow. Yep. Okay.
Sorry. Okay, now, so the first one, they talk about the Masons in hushed, hallowed tones and talk about them as being the good guys, and they tell you all this history. Well, nobody has to be an initiate to watch National Treasure. If they want to know the basic outline of Masonic history, it's all in there.
Yeah.
Now, that movie is all about searching for a national treasure. Do you reckon that's an allegory for something?
Yeah.
It's an allegory for a treasure, like the movie says, that we're all entitled to. What is that treasure?
Yeah, no,
it's the bonds. It's the bonds with our birth tied to our birth certificates. Where does the movie end? Where do they actually locate the treasure?
National Treasure 2. They go and dig up.
No, not number two. Number one.
It's underneath a graveyard.
Underneath a graveyard, Trinity Church. Where is that church?
In New York City, on Wall Street.
New York City, the corner of Wall Street and Broadway. Mm. Now, just yesterday, as it happens, that's why
we're out of time here.
We're
Glenn,
out of time.
You,
sorry, mate. But
well, find out the two buildings that are across the street.
All right. Do you have a website at all, Gordon?
I do not, but I'm about to start giving some seminars.
All right. Well, make sure you send that information through to me, and I'll put it up on my website for you there. Thanks so much for coming on, man. It's been pretty inspirationally awesome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Great info. Have you on again, okay?
Okay, brilliant.
All right, there he goes, ladies and gentlemen, Gordon Israel. It's been exciting. And we'll be back tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen, with more of the lighter side of genocide at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. See you tomorrow.